Hello, this is Dr. Shiva. Welcome to our podcast, Get Educated or Be Enslaved.
Episode 1629, air date December 20th, 2025.
The man, the myth, and the legend, that is Dr. Shiva. Dr. Shiva, how are you, sir?
Good, how are you doing?
Very well, sorry for the wee bit of confusion, but delighted that you're there. Whereabouts are you in the world at the moment?
I'm in Boston.
Boston. Yes. You've got 4 degrees from MIT, is that correct?
Yes, are we starting? Are we live? Or?
Yeah, we are. We're on the show, we're live, we're broadcasting to the world.
Well, good to be here. Where should we start?
Well, I was just going to say, you've got 4 degrees from MIT.
Yep.
Do you think that served you well in your career?
Well, you know, I didn't know about MIT until 2 weeks before I applied. Even though I was an extraordinarily good student in science and math, the high school I went to never even told me about MIT. So I happened to learn about it from a random person who was a friend of two women that became homeless because they were involved in a divorce that my mother helped. So it's totally fortuitous, even though I went to a very, very good public high school. But this was in the 1970s, early 80s, when, you know, I was one of only two, with my sister, two kids in a school of 4,000 kids in a primarily white school system. There's no racism really here. Perhaps there is, maybe I'm being kind, but even though I was a best student, no one even told me about MIT. So it was just lucky in the sense I heard about MIT, but I think it served me to the extent that I was really able to understand. I mean, MIT, Harvard, I'm looking over, I have a house where I can see all the two universities. You know, these are the center of the intelligentsia. I mean, Oxford is probably another center in terms of where young intellectuals are drafted and trained to serve the swarm. And intellectuals are an interesting class, but not really a class or a group, right? Of people who get the weapons of knowledge, training, analytical thinking, and then how they choose to use that knowledge is really their own decision. Typically, most of the intelligentsia serves the existing establishment to oppress, exploit other people for maximizing power, profit, control. In my case, I guess I never forgot where I came from. So I decided to use that knowledge to help deliver truth, freedom, health. And that's what my life's been about. So in that sense, MIT really taught me how the machinery of the existing establishment worked. And I would say that the people I met there, some of the good professors, some of the things I was exposed to, gave me opportunities that others probably would not have access to.
It's quite interesting because we always have a joke on the show here. Whenever we see someone towing the British establishment line, they've nearly all been to Cambridge University. That seems to be the place that they all go to. And it seems to be that all these people end up working as spies.
Yeah, so if you look at what's interesting is if you look at Cambridge and Oxford, they were really the centers of intellectual power. And I would argue that those two institutions still have enormous power, even to the U.S. intelligentsia. So if you think about it, someone gets, you know, the Rhodes Scholarship, for example, reveals that, right? Many high-ranking presidents or influential people in the United States get the Rhodes Scholarship, which is basically a scholarship started in the name of Cecil Rhodes, Oxford. They spend 2 years at Oxford and they get anointed as ready to serve the establishment, you know? So I would say Cambridge, Oxford still have an enormous amount of impact on the global, the academia and intelligentsia. To your point, most of the intellectuals practice the oldest profession in the world. And you can think about what that is. And they serve the interests of the swarm. So I chose not to do that. I have a deep, deep hatred towards them. And I think they need to be shattered, because I think primarily they are not using their intellectual skills to advance humankind. It's advance a very, very small set of people. So, and they perpetuate these institutions as though they are the centers of power by ensuring that the people they get to join these institutions perpetuate those institutions. So anyway, so I love putting MIT PhD at the end of my name, because the random person or most of these intellectuals have so much reverence for it. So my putting that, and then establishing the fact that I'm actually fighting against them, sort of really, really pisses them off, right? So it's a good thing.
I mean, obviously, you're a bright person. I think you need me to say that. Like, and clearly, you could have had a particularly strong career as part of that establishment. What kind of was it that made you go down that different route? I always find that interesting. Like, I mean, many of us have had opportunities, I think, where we could have just, you know, decided, well, I'm gonna, in a very simplistic way, I'm just gonna take the blue pill and go back to sleep. What was it that made you decide to go on the journey you've been on?
Yeah, I think I was compelled to it. It really began, believe it or not, it's gonna be hard for people to believe, when I was 4 years old. You know, India, as you know, has a caste system, a very delineated caste system, not that different than Britain. In fact, the British are the ones who, the British colonialists who came are the ones who reinstalled a caste system in India, which was starting to decay, because it's a wonderful way to control people. So the caste system in India originally originated as a guild system, as did in many feudal systems. You know, like if you were good at broadcasting, you became a broadcaster. If you were good at carpentry, that's what you did, right? And at some point, David, that guild system got transformed into a much more oppressive system, which went like this. If you were born the son of a carpenter, you must be a carpenter. If you were born the son of a broadcaster, you're supposed to be a broadcaster. If you're born the son of a professor, you must be a professor, you see? And these roles were given very specific names and categories. So in India, one category is called the Brahmins, B-R-H-A-M-I-N-S, which were the scholars or the priesthood who supposedly had a direct connection to God. And they were on the top of that caste system. And they would advise the kings, who were the next tier. The kings were called the Rajas, who would then, the next level was the warrior class, you know, the Kshatriyas, people who fought, and then the business class, and then the rest of everyone else who did all the manual labor called the Shudras, okay? Very defined caste system. That caste system, by the 8th century in India, was actually starting to break up. And by the 15th century in India, you know, the embryonic changes were taking place. So when the various people came to India to trade initially with this emerging caste, the British realized we don't need this caste. We don't need the rising Indian entrepreneurs. Let's set it back to the old caste system, because it's a great way to control people. So you had the setting of the caste system in India. So my earliest memory, the reason I give you that background, was we were in the Shudras, which were quote unquote untouchables. And I didn't know anything about this. As a 4 year old kid, I was playing football with one of my friends, going to his house, thinking I'm going to go to his house and, you know, get some water. And his mother would not let me into his house. She started yelling at me, calling me this Shudra word, and telling me that I should stay out, and gave me water in a very, very different, like garbage can looking cup, you see? So that's when I asked my mother, what is this? And she told me that we have this caste system. So obviously as a kid, I was very, very affected by this. And that started my real journey to understand these political systems of oppression, believe it or not. So it started at a very, very early age. So one could argue I was compelled to understand this. So my journey to education was driven by that, and also by this other very interesting thing where my grandmother was a traditional healer. And she practiced an ancient system of Indian medicine, which I've talked about, which I saw her empirically help people using ways to reset people's bodies to their natural systems. So I was, you know, intrigued by medicine and politics. And now, you know, 57 years later, that's what I do. You know, I worked in the medical school, created the first email system, got a bunch of degrees at MIT. I participate in politics, but I also have created many, many new innovations in health, particularly a technology which can literally do medical research, you know, 10 times faster than the existing institutions. I haven't talked about that a lot, but that's cytosol. But the reality is health and politics are very, very closely related. Wealthy people can afford good health, and the vast majority of working people are subjugated to the medical industrial complex. So politics and health are ultimately, you know, intertwined.
So obviously I really started seeing a lot of your stuff and everything that was there during the COVID scamdemic. I mean, what were you as outspoken before that, or would you say that was really when you really started speaking out?
Well, here's the thing. So if you go back to that point, 2019, 2020, I was probably the, I think we got a total, if you look at 2019 to 2021, probably about 1 billion unique video views, because it was a meeting of two things, politics and medicine. Since 1981, I've been an activist. David, you can go to my website. You'll see me doing all sorts of activism work, since campus activism, organizing, working people, all sorts of stuff. So it's not like I woke up like a lot of these grifters and said, oh, I'm going to be an activist. It's been a long journey. You know, I organized food service workers. There's a picture of me burning the South African flag on the steps at MIT. I was one of the earliest people to come out against the US-Iraq war. So if you look at that journey, when I went to India, I was appointed by the Prime Minister of India to run the largest innovation center during my Fulbright after I finished it. Now, I could have had a very cozy job, and I was the one who exposed the depths of corruption in Indian science and had to leave India. That was in 2010 under death threats. So I've been consistently fighting. Okay. And that's been one journey. But the other thing is I've been consistently innovating and consistently in medicine. So all these three things have weaved together. So in 2019, before the COVID quote unquote pandemic took place, I was invited by the National Science Foundation, and you can find it, to give a talk. It's a very prestigious thing. It's called a prestige lecture at Purdue University. And I gave a very detailed talk about the immune system, right? The immune system is really the operating system of health. And the fact that the immune system that we were using to develop vaccines was based on a model of 1920. And that we really need to look at the immune system in a very different way. And everyone accepted it. When 2020 came, late 2019 and 2020, I was already organizing large protests, because prior to the COVID nonsense, people were trying to impose vaccine mandates. You probably remember that. So I was leading those efforts. And in 2020, when Fauci came out with these concept of lockdowns, I was the first one to call them out. But not only that, I also gave solutions. You know, we probably affected at least a minimum of 200 million people's lives. We said, take vitamin D3, take quercetin, take zinc, you know, iodine, which can boost the immune system. While Booby effing Kennedy, aka Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was promoting lockdowns. Okay? And people, and we were the first ones to call him out as part of the establishment, who was acting like he was for quote unquote medical freedom. So, so it was literally the coming together of my long work in science and medicine and activism. So it was a very powerful meeting point. And remember, I was independent of the left and the right. And we got massive amount of limelight, views, and people really had great appreciation of what we did. But that's why it led to the shadow banning thereafter, David, because they cannot have independent voices exposing things. You see, even the exposition of truth must be done by the anointed ones that they want, so they can control the dissemination of, they can control the narrative, you see?
Talk to me about email then, because that's that, like, your sort of big claim is you're the inventor of email, and a few people, talk to me about that. I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, so the thing is, let's just look at, dissect your question. Your big claim is the claim. First of all, I just want to, and don't take this personally, Bill Gates, no one ever says Bill Gates claims to have invented DOS, do they? No one ever says, no, they don't claim. They just say he invented DOS. He started Microsoft. He did the work. No one claims, no one says Mark Zuckerberg claims to have invented Facebook.
Well, I would say Mark Zuckerberg claims to have invented Facebook. His story is quite dodgy, isn't it? I mean, whether I don't believe he did invent it, to be honest with you. But
Wikipedia won't say that, you see? So the reality, the facts of my inventing email are so black and white. A very good friend of mine who used to be the owner of Business Insider, when he heard the facts, he said, you know what's fascinating is why do people use the word claim? You have to ask yourself, why did you use that? And again, don't take this personally. And the facts are so clear on this. The issue is, why don't people say the military industrial complex claims to have invented email? So let's walk through that journey, the facts. And if people go to inventorofemail.com or whoinventedemail.com, they can get the actual facts. So in 1978, I was a 14-year-old kid. I think I came to the United States in 1970. I was a very hardworking 14-year-old kid, but not only that, I also played sports. I could have gone to the professional sports route. So it wasn't just a, you know, nerd. And I had gone to New York University while in high school, David, in a computer science program. So I don't know how old you are. How old are you, David?
I'm 43.
Okay, so I'm 61.
82, anywhere, I was born.
Yeah, so email was created by me in 78. So if you were to go back to 1970s and you were to look at any organization, like your news organization or organization of the parliament, the prime minister, an organization of the hospital, right? Government, how did people communicate in that period? How did people communicate within an office, within an organization?
Was it internal messaging systems?
They didn't have messaging. They didn't have electronic messaging systems. How did they
communicate? Facsimiles? Faxing? Was that not a big thing they used?
Fax hadn't really come out yet. They communicated two ways. They had physical phones, not cell phones.
Yeah, that's right. People on the phone. Right? Yeah,
so
that's right.
If you were in an office and I was in an office, and let's say you were a doctor.
Phone each other, yeah.
Yeah, you'd phone each other, and you had these little buttons called extensions. And the other most powerful way, and you can go look at this, every organization, I don't know if I can share my screen, but every organization in the world.
You've muted yourself. You've muted yourself.
Oh, I didn't. Okay. Can I share my screen or no?
Yeah, you can share your screen.
Okay, so. So the other way that offices communicated was through what was called as the inter-office mail system, okay? Or sometimes it's called the inter-organizational mail system, okay?
Yeah. Memos. Someone just mentions that in the chat. Memos, that was a big thing, wasn't it, in offices in America?
Yes.
Did you get the memo?
Yes.
So
exactly.
Someone would go around and, like, remember all the 80s films, like Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox, and they would... They put a memo around all the desks.
Exactly. So you nailed it. It was called the memo, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The memo. So here's by the way, people go to whoinventedemail.com. And to your point, they had this thing called a memo. Do you see this?
Mm-hmm.
The secretary would sit. I assume you can see my screen.
Yep. I've got it up on the screen now.
By the way, this was a very classic scene of that period. A secretary sitting at her desktop, right? On the desktop, you notice she had the phone. She had this thing called a typewriter. Mm-hmm. These were inbox, the outbox. These were folders. Okay, there would actually be a third folder called a drafts folder. She had paper clips in here. Sometimes she had whiteout, and underneath her desk, she had something called a trash can. This memo, as you said, would be written to from CC, BCC, date, subject. It was a very structured document, and it would be put into these interoffice envelopes, and it would be sent throughout these pneumatic tubes. See these?
That's and right. Then, yep. That's right. Okay. Yep.
Okay. So do you understand this is a complex system consisting of many, many features? Okay. Let me stop sharing here and I'll show you another screen. Okay. So that was the interoffice mail system. So if you went to the White House or to the office of the Prime Minister, this is how they, or to a hospital. Okay. So in fact, the interoffice mail system was the powerhouse of communications in offices. And every one of those features I just went through with you, David, were extremely important in that communications process. It was not simply sending a text message. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to, so as a child, 14 or teenager, I got a job working full-time in this medical school because I graduated top of the class at a New York University computer science program. Okay, 40 students were selected all over the United States. And while working at this medical school, I was doing research in medicine, why kids were dying in their sleep. And I did very well doing some software programming. And I was asked to convert this entire system. You see this table here? If you can see it?
Mm-hmm.
These are the components of that interoffice mail system. Inbox, outbox, drafts, as you said, memo. And the memo had to, from, subject, attachments, folders. You had to be able to compose a memo, forward a memo, reply, an address book, groups, return receipt. You have to be able to sort, scan. All of these features, David, carbon copies. You literally put, if you were sending two blah with a CC to someone else, you literally took a piece of carbon paper, okay? Blind carbon, registered mail. You could send a memo to you and make sure you acknowledge you responded to me. So this, do you understand? This is not simply text messaging. This is a complex system. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to convert that entire system to the electronic form. As a 14-year-old child, I wrote 50,000 lines of code, all of them, which are here. And you can literally go see all the code. By the way, this is all in the National Museum of American History now. Okay? I named this system email. I defined email. Okay? I named the system email. There's the code. I put all of those features that you see in every modern email system into electronic form. And subsequent to that, I was awarded the first United States copyright, which is right here, for the invention of this system. Okay? At that time, copyright was the only way to protect software inventions, according to the courts, because they had not allowed software patents. I have the patent. I named it email. I wrote all the code. Okay? There's no question. It's black and white who invented email. I invented email. The problem is brown kids like myself who come from Indian families are not taught to be PR experts, public relations like Bill Gates was, who didn't invent anything. So I created that, went to MIT. And in fact, if you go to this website, you'll see on the front page, a year before you were married, I mean, you were born. you will see on the front page of this site, when I first came to MIT, is a news article, okay? Which has in right there, this is the MIT 1981. When I first arrived, there's a news article which says, you know, 1,000 kids came to MIT. And three of them had done something quite interesting. One of them created email, okay? So there was no doubt who created email. I created email. But I was more interested in medicine. Went to MIT, now fast track to 2012, about 33 years later, right? 2011, 1978 when I invented email. My mother is dying of a horrible disease. And called pulmonary fibrosis. which I didn't know, in a suitcase. She gives me all the documentation of my invention of email, which she had meticulously saved, David, which I had, frankly, didn't promote. The editor of Time Magazine, the senior technology editor, reviewed all that material, and he wrote an article in November 2011 called "A Man Who Invented Email." Again, if you go to that website, it's fully documented there. I didn't ask for this publicity. He was just fascinated, like, why doesn't anyone know about this? Okay? And you can see that article right here. Okay, the Time Magazine article is right here, okay? So I encourage people to go read that article, okay? So here's that article that came out, okay? November 15th, sorry, 2011. 3 months after this, the Smithsonian contacted me. Remember, I didn't want any of this publicity. And they said, wow, this is amazing. We didn't know this existed. If anyone doesn't know Smithsonian, National Museum of American History is probably the leading museum in the world. You know, they have Alexander Graham Bell's phones, right? The telegraph. So they wanted all my material. So they honored me on February 16th, 2012 in a ceremony. All of these materials were accepted into the Smithsonian. And a Washington Post reporter wrote an article called "Dr. Shiva Ayyadurai Honored by the Smithsonian." That's the story. Now, it didn't end there. Right when that occurred, the existing academic intellectuals for 30 years had written a fake history claiming that email was created as a part of the ARPANET. Okay? But they never called it email, simple text messaging. It was no different than Samuel Morse sending simple text messages from point A to point B. Okay? Email is not the simple exchange of text messages between electronic devices. Email is the system. That's the first important understanding. I created email. I've never claimed to create electronic messaging. That credit goes to Samuel Morse. Okay? At that time, when this went into the Smithsonian, Raytheon, I'm sure you're familiar with who they are, a $40 billion defense company, had just purchased this company called BBNN, and they changed their logo to the at symbol. And at that time was when cybersecurity was a big business. Missile sales were down. So they were promoting themselves as the inventors of email, using a guy who looked like a fucking nerd, glasses, beard, pocket protector, who by his own accord said he did not invent email. He wrote 15 minutes of code to simply attach text to a bottom of a remote file. That's like a caveman version of Reddit or Facebook. That is not email. So when this went in, they manufactured a controversy. Why? Because if the invention of email was not done at MIT, not done by the military industrial complex, but done by a 14-year-old kid in Newark, New Jersey, what does that say about the origins of innovation? And by the way, a 14-year-old boy is the one who invented TV, Philo Farnsworth. And he underwent a very similar type of attack. So when that went into the Smithsonian, was a bomb went off. Gawker Media, which luckily went bankrupt, and I'm glad we put them into bankruptcy, called me a curry-stained Indian. Not they, but they said I'm an asshole and a dick. You know, multiple articles, three articles. They also, that led other people to write this curry-stained Indian should be beaten and hanged. Okay? And it took me 4 years to sue Gawker. We won. We filed a $35 million lawsuit. They claimed bankruptcy. I was given $1 million. And they were forced to remove those three defamatory articles. Now, during that period, 2012 to 2015, Wikipedia could not accept this fact, the so-called liberal woke Wikipedia. They locked my page. You can even edit the facts. And they were trying to rename what email was. Uppercase email is not different than lowercase email. Noam Chomsky, the linguist, had to come out and jump in on this. And he said, these are ridiculous tantrums. So the issue I ask you is, why do you use the word claim? Again, don't take it personally. When the facts, it's black and white. And why was a controversy created? And I'll tell you why. It's because the thought of great innovations not coming from MIT, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, that it could come from the edges. Newark, New Jersey, if you look it up, is one of the poorest cities in the United States. I was working in a small medical college and a 14-year-old brown-skinned kid. So it's multiple layers of issues to the existing establishment, which say only...
I can kind of sympathize that that would have been the case 30, 40 years ago. I mean, that would have been seen as heretical. But surely now, in the current system we have now, would you not have a vast swathe of people looking back on this and saying, well, look, this was the real guy? You know, would that not fit the agenda?
Well, it depends. So you're asking a great question. So remember, this is 2012. So you have to really understand, a good friend of mine, Mitch, said, it's very hard for people to understand your journey because they haven't walked in your shoes, okay? What you say sounds theoretically plausible. But in my case, like Philo Farnsworth, I don't know if he's the one who created TV, it took 60 years. And he's not even having a racism issue. He was a white guy, young kid in Franklin, Idaho, who created TV in his barn lab. RCA came and stole it and started manufacturing it. It took him 19 years to win a lawsuit. He died an alcoholic. It took 60 years to get him recognition. So the first...
I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on all of this because so much of history is a lie. So as I say, I'm agnostic. I'm neither a believer nor a disbeliever because yeah, so much of our history is a lie.
Yeah, so yeah, I think the issue is, you're making a very good point, David. The lies that are created, which becomes propaganda, right? Why are they created? So why create the lie? And why was there such defamation, such brutal attacks? What occurred to Philo and to me was because of the fact, it comes back to this issue with the caste system. If it turns out that great innovations can occur for low money. I mean, I was paid, just to let you know, $1.25 per hour. The first 2 years, I didn't get paid anything. I was just so happy as a kid to be able to innovate. I wasn't even looking for money, right? I was a 14-year-old kid working with people 40, 50, 60 years of age. So I was just amazed. I got access to computers. I got to innovate. It was the thrill of innovation. It wasn't monetarily driven. But if innovation can come from Philo Farnsworth in Franklin, Idaho, on a small farm, if innovation can come from an inner city, small college in Newark, New Jersey, like great innovations, TV and email, what does that say?
Well, is that not the big thing about AI, that the reality is all these companies are ridiculously overvalued and most of the stuff they do is not actually that complicated? It's just
exactly.
It's all PR.
It's all PR. So if you look at, so, but I hope, just to finish on, I want to talk about AI, that gives you that context, right? The invention of email. Now, the problem they have with me, David, is it's not like I'm some wacko guy saying, oh, I invented email. Well, I went to MIT, did a degree in electrical engineering, did a degree in mechanical engineering, design, and a PhD in biological engineering, and won every major award while I was at MIT. The Fulbright, right? Created companies which were featured on MIT's technology review. But the day I said that email was not done at MIT by the military, but it was done before I came to MIT. This is problematic. You see?
But okay, but let's get on to something which, again, I think people will perhaps find a bit more sympathy with you, in that you are exceptionally outspoken about a certain group of people who exert a very large influence on the United States of America and obviously the world, and that is, you know, Jewish Zionists. Do you think that your thoughts on that perhaps have an implication on why you are maligned?
No, I don't think so. And I have to be very clear here. You use the word Jewish Zionist. I don't think you should do that because you're falling in to the establishment which wants to conflate Jewishness with Zionism. Throughout my history...
Surely Zionism is the manifestation of Jewishness.
No, it's not true.
The Jewish state would say different, which, you know... Every poll shows 90 to 95% of Jews support.
Well, I think let's go over this ignorance, okay? Because since 1981, I've been one of the biggest fighters against Zionism. Again, the year before you were born, there was a huge protest. There's a guy called Meir Kahana, who is a rabid.
I know who he is. Yeah.
Yeah. And he came to Brandeis University and this is around the time, I think it was 83, sorry, a year after you were born, when Sabra and Shatila, Israeli tanks ran over. So anyway, here's the reality. First of all, Zionism, like Brahmanism, like Nazism, is a political ideology. Theodor Herzl was an atheist. Okay, you have Hindus,
but he was a racial Jew.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So you have Jews who are an ethnicity, and some of them practice Judaism. Okay, so you have to be very careful, because many of the people who helped me throughout my life were working class Jews who may have been Jews, but they didn't practice Judaism, nor did they believe in Zionism. So you have to be very, very careful about this, because the establishment has a bunch of these grifters, like a guy called Jake Shields. I don't know if you know him.
You know him very well, yeah.
Well, Jake didn't know shit about Zionism or Judaism. I was the one who first he called, and I had a three-hour conversation. Overnight, he's promoted Nick Fuentes, Dan Bilzerian, and they actively conflate Jewishness with Zionism. And I would argue that they're being promoted in order so the establishment in all the countries can equate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. Very, very dangerous. Let me finish. Zionism is a political ideology. It is about promoting a small set of people subjugating others, okay? Brahmanism is like that. Brahmanism is a concept that a few set of people who are on the top should be better than everyone else. Not all Hindus are Brahmins, but it is interesting. During this entire recent events in Gaza, Hindu Brahmins who believe in Brahmanism were supporting the Zionists in Israel. Moreover, there's 70 million Christian evangelicals who are Zionists. There are Saudi Arabian Muslims who are Zionist. There are Hindus, as I said, who are Zionists. If you add all that up, the numbers, there are far more non, quote unquote, ethnic Jewish Zionists, I would say order of 10x or 20x, than there are, quote unquote, Jewish Zionists. So we have to be very, very careful, because I know many Jews who are anti-Zionist.
Yeah, okay? But my experience is the vast majority of Jews who are anti-Zionist aren't always acting in the interests of the nation state in which they live either. You know, they may be anti-Zionist, but they still engage in what I would coin Jewish behavior.
Well, now you're talking about something else. You're talking about Jewish behavior. Okay. That would be like me saying English behavior. Okay.
Well, it is a generalization, and that is the reality of the world.
No, I don't think so. Zionism is a political ideology, which serves imperialism. Zionism is racism in the service of imperialism. Brahmanism is racism in the service of imperialism. Nazism is racism in the service of imperialism. These are political ideologies.
Is race not a real concept?
Yeah, race is a real concept. Race exists.
Are these ideologies not just downstream from race?
No, they're created, David. So you could take I'll give you an example. Politicians in villages in India, you'll have a Hindu politician and a Muslim politician. The Hindu guys will go among the Hindus and say, the Muslims just said, you guys smell. Oh my God, riots will take place. So in countries where you have a lot of different ethnicities, the people who want to divide people can say anything, and it will create division among people, and the people who say that can organize. Now, Britain, many ways still, as I've mentioned back, still has tremendous intellectual, ideological control in many, many ways, created the concept of divide and rule. That's what they did in Africa, same in India. And in that area of the Middle East, the aspects of Zionism were very, very valuable for creating chaos and division, which U.S. and British imperialism could come and quote unquote resolve. Okay, wonderful way of control. So Zionism is a political ideology which was created by Theodore Herzl, served the interests of imperialism, just like Brahminism did, just like Nazism did. And we could have a long discussion on this, but I'm an anti-Zionist.
You did mention Noam Chomsky, and this sounds to me like sort of the typical Chomskyite position. But
Chomsky and I had major differences. Chomsky was not into building a movement. Chomsky would talk a lot, but demoralize people into doing anything. So the Chomskyite position.
Chomsky's told Hassan Nasrallah that America runs Israel and they would never assassinate him. Chomsky told Nasrallah to stop talking about Jews and talk about Zionists. No, Hassan Nasrallah was blown up with an underground bunker busting bomb.
That doesn't. I don't know what you're saying. It doesn't have. It's irrelevant.
You can find this offensive. You can disagree with it. My take on it is: Jews act as a team. Now, occasionally within that team, there will be competing factions, but at the end of the day, they're all Jews.
Yeah, but WASPs act as a team. Gujaratis act as a team. You could say this about everyone. You could say Australians act as a team.
I think being anti-Zionist is, I mean, look, as I said, I don't have any hostility towards your position. I think it's the safe place to be in the argument, you know.
Not a safe place. It's the right place because what you are doing is you are falling into the trap of those in power who want to pass laws that if you say anything against the state of Israel, that is equated anti-Zionism, not Trump.
That is a very fair point because the Zionist entity loves anti-Semitism. You know, they want you to be as anti-Semitic as possible.
Exactly.
Then they can turn around and say, "Well, you all need to move to Israel, and we need $10 billion to defend us." So, look, I do have sympathy with that argument. Problem is, kind of let them off in that regard.
No, you're not letting anyone off. In fact, it is the argument that not only does not let them off, but also the Zionists in the United States. Do you know how many of these Christian evangelical ministers, like, you know, we in our movement, Truth, Freedom, Health?
That's a big problem. I don't doubt that whatsoever.
They are heavily, they're not Jews. They are Christian evangelicals throughout the Southern, but you need to understand the extent of this because the people that are promoting this, I'm sorry, they're newbies into this discussion. They're jumping in because they're getting views and clicks to promote this nonsense. And it's actually undermining the exposition of Zionism. And it's really disgraceful. The reality is that if you look in the United States, just one example, you go through the Southern Baptist Belt, all those churches which control the thoughts of 100 million Americans. Those are controlled by these right-wing, left-wing, whatever you want to call them, these fanatic evangelical Christian pastors who literally report up to Israel. They're funded. And those people are not Jews, ethnic Jews, or Jews who follow Judaism, you know, religious-wise. They are as white American Christian, and some of them are Black, Hispanics. Hispanic, Black, white Christians, 70 million of them, who were fine with the destruction of Gaza. Now, in our movement, we educated people. We had a lot of people in the South who were going to church. They said, "Holy shit, Dr. Shiva's saying the right thing." Okay? And they would go have arguments with their pastors, and many of them left their churches. That's what needs to happen. Zionism is racism in the service of imperialism. All these fucking morons out there who are promoting, purposely conflating the two, are serving the interest
again,
of Zionism.
Where I take kind of issue with is when you say racism, like, as I say, I don't hate people. I don't live in hate. I recognize race is real. If race wasn't real, you wouldn't have separate countries. You have different countries are an embodiment of a nation. A nation is a tribe of people. The country then is that So I just believe that race is real, and I don't think we should yeah, deny so, that but, concept.
Yeah, but the issue is, David, the if you go back to the mid 1800s, the quote unquote Jews you're referring to were Europeans racially, okay?
Well, I mean, I know there's been a lot of interbreeding. Like,
let's not do mental masturbation. They were Europeans, and
well,
they were Europeans. Yes,
there was interbreeding.
No, but they were Europeans fundamentally. If you go look at the Palestinians in Palestine who are living there, there is enough records to say they were the original Jews of Jesus. And many of them converted to Islam when Britain moved the Zionists in. And to your point, and I think we can concur on this, the Zionists were embraced by Hitler because the Zionists embraced Hitler because he promoted anti-Semitism, which helped people build their ranks. So anti-Semitism is loved by the Zionists. Zionists love anti-Semitism. Repeat, Zionists love anti-Semitism.
But what do I say when non-Zionist, I see it's Jews that run porn companies, Jews that run BlackRock, Jews that run all these things that cause run OnlyFans, right, that promote abortion. I mean, as I said, these aren't Zionists. These are ethnic Jews doing these things.
Yeah, but what is Trump? Trump owned, casinos. Trump is president. Is he Jewish?
Well, there's some questions about his father's parentage, okay. But I don't think he's ethnically Jewish, no.
Yeah, he's not Jewish, okay? Rockefeller, is he Jewish?
No.
JP Morgan, is he Jewish?
No.
We could go down the list, okay?
Well, I agree there are globalists. Is WASP that caused trouble? I'm not disagreeing with that.
No, but is Ambani, is he Jewish?
No.
Wealthiest guy in India, okay? Is the prince of Saudi Arabia Jewish? No, but he's a fucking Zionist. Okay? So
yeah.
you have to go beyond this, David, because this view is what is hurting the movement against Zionism and against the atrocities of Israel. Because when you take that position, it is not a position of strength to really educate people. And to really expose what Zionism is, it is a fucking political ideology, which is racist, which serves the interests of imperialism. And that is what Zionism is. No different than Brahminism. That's why if you saw the posts I put out, I said I'm the only presidential candidate who does not suck Zionist cock. Okay? Right after October 7th, long before these grifters came along doing this conflation, and they're heavily promoted. Because the establishment wants to conflate Jewishness with Zionism. That plays into the laws that the United States wants to pass, which it has passed, right? So you have to be very, very careful. What is the goal here? Is the goal to defeat Zionism, or is the goal to just start attacking Jews? What's the goal?
Well, I think of Jews as a group behaved better, then we wouldn't have these issues. That's just my understanding. I don't wake up in the morning and just say I don't like Jews. I just look at what I see a lot is wrong with the world, and many of them happen to be ethnic and racial Jews.
Well, let me give you a personal experience. Remember I said I came to the United States in 1970? Well, my parents were very poor. We first settled in an all-black community called Paterson, New Jersey. All blacks. Okay? Then after my parents made a little bit of money, we moved to Clifton, New Jersey, which is blacks and whites. Then Parsippany, which is predominantly working class whites. And guess what? Where I settled the last 3 years of high school, Livingston, New Jersey. Guess who lived in that town? The Kushners, Jared Kushner's father. Okay. It was the Zionist Jews. So if you look at my own journey, my sixth grade teacher was Mr. Roth, a working class Jew who fought in the Navy. He was on the boat when the bomb in Hiroshima fell. Very different kind of Jew than the Zionist Jews in Livingston, New Jersey, who were so jealous of me, and they used to talk about the chosen people. They didn't even tell me about MIT. All right. So I've experienced quote unquote Jews. All right. So it is absolutely, and I've also experienced racism from WASP whites. Okay. Very wealthy, as well as from Arab, as well as from Indians. I'll tell you who the biggest people who do this distinction and who support Israel are: Brahmin Indians. The biggest fucking
Yeah, I mean, that is the big thing. You know, you look at the sort of slavish support from Israel that does come from India. There is.
But not the 1.5 billion.
I'm not saying that your argument in itself is without some merit, but I just take a slightly more simplistic view of it. And I think if you do get into nuance, if you do get into the, you will always find an exception to the rule. And
well, I think the Jews don't.
Sometimes you need a, as Netanyahu himself said, he says, if you're looking for the needle in the haystack, sometimes you just have to take out the haystack. And, you know, I don't think you beat these people by being the nice guy. I think you have to play them at their own game. And if you look at people who do try and out nice them, they eviscerate them.
They killed
Nasrallah. They said they wouldn't. They killed him. They're going to overthrow Iran. You know, people need to play hardball with these people and stop being so nice to them.
Let's talk about people need to play hardball. First of all, these people, the Zionists, your model is to wipe out all the Jews. That's what you're telling me.
I never said that. That is not what I'm suggesting. I don't believe in any individual.
But what do you mean? We should play hardball. No, but where does it?
I think the Zionist entity. You need to play hardball with the Zionist entity.
Yeah, but see what you just did. You conflated Judaism, Jews, with Zionism. So when you say we need to play hardball, you're saying that I'm being nice by being nuanced. It's not nuanced. It's a political fact. Zionism is a political ideology. Jewish represents a whole range of people, just like Indians represents 1.6 billion people. A subset of those Indians, okay, are Brahmins who support.
But what? Okay, you want to know what my position is? I don't believe in the state of Israel should exist.
I don't either.
It should be allowed to exist.
I also
don't believe that in Western countries Jews should be allowed to hold positions of power.
Jews, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jews. Right, just well, Jews. Straight up Jews. Ethnic, religious Jews shouldn't be allowed to have positions of power.
Yeah. All right.
And that was the case for most of, you know, the last 1800, 1900 years.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, that's your position. I would argue that Brahmins shouldn't be able to hold positions of power. I would argue Zionists. I would argue Nazis, you see? Because they are and you could be a Jewish Brahmin. You could be a Muslim Zionist. You could be a black Nazi. They cross barriers.
But again, I just think that the when push comes to here's my analysis of it. See, when you're in prison, how do gangs break down? Do they break down on ideological lines or do they break down on racial lines?
It depends. You have Wall Street gangs and you go to Wall Street
prison.
Gang.
In prison. I'm talking about when your life is threatened, how do they break down?
Yeah, so look, race is a very visceral way to break up people.
Correct.
Okay. But it's not the only way. I can take you to MIT, let me finish, or Harvard, or to the medical mafia, which is a gang. We could have a whole discussion about that. And they're of all races. And I would argue that they're much more lethal than a prison gang. Okay. And it's a multi-racial, decentralized mafia.
If you look back on, I mean, look, we've not got time to discuss it. Here's the thing. I am not unsympathetic to your view. I'm sure we agree about most things.
But I just think this issue needs to be cleared, which will strengthen the fight against Zionism.
Well, I am sympathetic to the position that the more anti-Semitism there is, the more it helps them. And that is the double-edged sword.
Why give Zionists even an inch? Because
they want obviously the situation that happened in Bondi. I mean, look at what they did on October 7th when the Netanyahu government, they killed the vast majority of Jews on that day. and they did it knowing it would further their cause. I think it's very complicated. As I say, I think anyone calling out Zionism is a start, and it is a position. There'll be different arguments that are there. Anyway, Dr. Shiva, that's been over an hour. I'm sure we could do it a lot longer. It is an interesting conversation, and you know, we do believe in free speech and debate. Have you got anything that you'd like to promote? Any websites? Anything if people want to speak to you further or support you? You're muted again. You're muted again.
I actually wanted to have a longer discussion. We can do a follow-up on
the health stuff. Let's do that.
On the health stuff we're doing. But fundamentally, you know, if people go to truthfreedomhealth.com, the work that brings it all together, David, is we've built a global movement of working people of all different backgrounds to educate them on the dynamics of political change from a system standpoint. So people get a clarity that these divisions that take place left and right, okay? These important differences that take place have one goal. The division is to make sure we as working people do not build a bottoms up movement. Okay. So that's a truth, freedom, health. But we recognize that in order to build this longer movement, you have to have educated people and they have to be healthy too. And those in power do not want people to get educated. They want to divide us, nor do they want people to be healthy. Thus, truth, freedom, health. So when you look at COVID, as we discussed earlier, COVID was central to our movement because we integrated science, why people needed to get on the ground and fight, and health. So Truth Freedom Health is our global movement. People should go to truthfreedomhealth.com. Every Thursdays, we hold two educational sessions, you know, for across the pond where you guys are in the morning, 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. But though that's something central I want to do. Now, out of Truth Freedom Health, we've created some very powerful solutions. One of them is a solution where we're educating people, David, and people can go to systemshealth.com, where we're taking, you know, people from the medical establishment, doctors, nurses, as well as alternative people. And I've created literally a new curriculum for looking at the body as a system, David. And we can have a whole discussion on that. Okay.
You know, let's do a follow-up. Yeah. The one thing I would say is I think possibly it would be worthwhile having a possible debate on some of the topics, but not with myself. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm here to facilitate an interview. I have my views, but there are people out there. So let's keep in touch.
I think it's a very, very important. I think it's a very important debate to have.
Are you banned on Twitter?
No. What they do with me, remember, I was the one who won the famous lawsuit against the government, exposing government has a backdoor portal. So they put me on Twitter. And again, this is a longer discussion, but they contain my reach. You see, that's a new form of censorship because they're afraid to censor me because they know I'll file a lawsuit and I'll win. So they'll put people on and they control your reach. Okay. I mean, Elon Musk said exactly what the head of the ADL said. Free speech does not equal free reach.
Very, very true. That's what Jonathan Greenblatt said. Anyway, yeah, listen, Dr. Shiva, thank you so much for coming on. Interesting stuff. We'll keep in touch.
Okay? Yeah, great discussion. Yeah, organize a debate between me and these people who
leave it with me. I think that would be interesting.
Yep. Be well, David.
Good man. Good night. Bye-bye now. Well. Bye-bye.
We have allowed our country to be taken over from within, and the end goal is you will have a homogenized world where we will become slaves, because there is a condition among the elites that really thinks they're better than you, deep down inside them, that you don't deserve the freedoms you have. They don't. This reality is what people need to wake up to, and we need to all unite working people. There's only one movement that can do that, and that is the movement that we started creating here in Massachusetts, the Movement for Truth, Freedom, and Health. Look, I've been a student of politics since I was a four-year-old kid, studying revolutionary movements, left wing, right wing. There's a physics, there's a nuclear science to destroying the establishment. To build a bridge, you need to understand Newton's equation. You need to understand the laws of gravity. You need to understand Poisson's ratio. There is a way to build a revolution. And that's why I put this together. My goal is to train a army of truth, freedom, and health leaders. We don't need followers like social media. We need leaders, but they need training because the educational system does not teach them history, nothing. So in 3 hours, that's what I've started doing. That's the solution. Wow. We got to train people first with understanding what a system is, the dynamics of all systems that affect nature. The second is understanding the interconnection between truth, freedom, and health. Freedom is the ability to move freely, communicate freely, talk freely. Without freedom, you cannot convert ideas, hypothesis into truth, which is science. And without freedom, you can't really get to truth. And without truth, you make up fake problems and fake solutions, which means you destroy our health. And without health, which is the infrastructure of us and our body, you can't fight for freedom. Truth, freedom, health. Third concept is it has to be bottoms up. Working people, people who work uniting. And what the right wing has done is whenever you say working people unite, that must be communist. Meanwhile, they've let the Democrats run unions, which suppress workers, completely corrupt. But when you look at the arc of American history, it's been when working people came up. We need to go local. Every solution I'm coming up with is a part of this movement. We're giving the science, which is the truth, and then we tell people what they can do on the ground. Like with election fraud, you don't need to wait for some lawyer. Our goal is to train people to go local, to go local, to go local, fight locally. Forget lawyers, forget politicians, forget celebrities. You got to learn politics, and there is a science to it. They lock us down, we should be ready to shut them down. And the fourth part of this principle is a not so obvious establishment. So when you look at a system, there's always something that disturbs you from getting to your goal. Well, the biggest disturbance is a not so obvious establishment, which are those people who claim they're for you on the left and the right. The Al Sharptons who tell black people I'm for you. The Tucker Carlsons. Do you think any true anti-establishment person will ever be on Fox or CNN? I don't think so. They both mislead working people back into the establishment. Without this solid understanding of political physics and theory, you're screwed. You're going to follow on the left wing Bernie Sanders. Oh, he said something. Or Robert Kennedy. Scumbags. Or you're going to follow some right-wing talk show host. They're not going to lead us to liberation. It's us. We're building a bottoms-up movement. And that political physics, it's a nuclear science of change. Bottoms up. We have to organize to understand that there is people who talk a good game and then look at what they actually do, left and right. I'm sorry, Sean Hannity may say some good things, but I don't see the urgency in his voice to get something done. And it can only come when you weaponize yourself with the right knowledge. You need to be able to identify a rat. You know, Christ didn't go after the Romans, right? It was the Pharisees and the Sadducees who screwed him up. His own quote unquote people. And that's where we're at. So these four concepts I've built into a curriculum where people can go to truthfreedomhelp.com, and it's an educational program. We need to train people in political theory. You need to have physics, and I've created that curriculum. People need to get educated. We need to get educated fast. And within a half an hour, I can teach people 2 years of MIT control systems. I teach people those concepts. Then I apply it. Anyone can understand it. And then you say, oh, I got to build a bottoms-up movement. They have to get politically astute, and then they have to go locally and act, not sit there on social media. They have to act locally, defy locally, do civil obedience locally, but with knowledge on how to build a movement. Now, the Senate campaign's expanded to the Movement for Truth, Freedom, and Health, and they can find it on truthfreedomhelp.com, so people can sign in, they can get access to a bunch of videos. If they want to take a course and become a Truth, Freedom, Health leader, I offer a full scholarship there, but we want people to make a commitment that they'll study, that they'll get certified, that they'll go do activities on the ground. So go to truthfreedomhelp.com. Welcome to VA Shiva. VA Shiva is a product of my journey across East and West, science and tradition, ancient and modern, that brings you the science of systems so you can become a force for truth, freedom, health. VA Shiva is a platform of revolutionary education, community building, and weaponry for unleashing local activism. My journey to VA Shiva begins in the chaos of Bombay, where I experienced diverse religions, languages, castes, and in a small village that had no running water, no electricity, where my grandmother, a poor village farmer, practiced Siddha, an ancient system of Indian medicine over 10,000 years old. She observed one's face, the art of Samudrika Lakshanam, to understand a body's unique constitution, allowing her to deliver the right medicine for the right person at the right time. Watching my grandmother heal others, I was inspired to study medicine, but I was also aware of the corrupt caste system of India, which denigrated a human being, where my family were considered low caste untouchables, where one's birth determined one's destiny. The grit and determination of my mother and father led them to get educated and to come to America, a one in a trillion event. Their actions inspired me to work hard and excel. While in ninth grade, I attended New York University in a computer science program, and subsequently, at the age of 14, was given a full-time job as a research fellow at what is now known as Rutgers Medical School in the heart of Newark, New Jersey. There, I investigated the system of sleep using mathematics, computer science, and biology for sudden infant death syndrome. It was there in Newark where I invented email when I was the first to convert every feature of the physical, paper-based inter-office mail system, including inbox, outbox, memo, carbon copy, blind carbon copy, attachments, into its electronic equivalent, a system which I named email, a term that I was the first to coin. On August 30th, 1982, I was awarded the first U.S. copyright for the invention of this system, recognizing me as the inventor of email. At that time, copyright was the only way to protect software inventions. I went on to MIT, where I earned 4 degrees across multiple systems of engineering, electrical, mechanical, design, biological. That training led me to invent many other systems for advancing humankind. Echomail, the world's first intelligent email management system. Cytosol, a computational biology system for eliminating animal testing to discover new medicines faster, cheaper, and safer. And to the creation of a whole systems methodology for certifying clean food. These innovations led me back on a Fulbright to India, where I discovered the missing link between Eastern medicine and Western systems theory, honoring my grandmother, to develop Your Body, Your System, a powerful tool that will help you understand how your body is a system and how the inputs of food, supplements, and exercise bring your body back to its natural system state. And Systems Health, an integrative educational discipline that is now integrated into the VA Shiva platform that will enable you to learn the science of systems, the science of everything, be it your body as a system or our society and politics as a system, to reveal the foundational interrelationships between truth, freedom, health. Now is the time for you to be the light, learn the science of systems, build community, and weaponize yourself to unleash the activism necessary to deliver truth, freedom, health in your local community. Welcome to VA Shiva.